and some dub. The 3Ds, that will get you by. Before that, we heard from Dave Clark and Keystone. Sorry, Dave Douglas and Keystone, my apologies. This past spring, Dave Douglas and experimental filmmaker Bill Morrison collaborated on a multimedia project entitled Spark of Being. From the soundtrack from Spark of Being, we heard Split Personality. And starting off the set was Jandek, or Yandek, if you will. And a live recording from Toronto, recorded at the Center of Gravity in 2006. A piece called Part One. Currently, we're listening to music from Sun Ara, a recording entitled Off Duty, and a piece entitled Last Chance. Chance. Not chance. 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 T. T. Chance with a T and an S. S. Chance. Morning music still ahead. A little sonic jam and peanut butter for the end of the show. You're listening to music for car washes. Don't get out of the car. Don't get out of the car.
Good afternoon. My name is Steve. You're listening to CFRU 93.3 FM here in Guelph. And we've been listening to Music for Car Washes, which is heard here every Wednesday at 17 o'clock. What's that? 17 minus 2, 5 o'clock p.m. We're going to be going to our regularly scheduled, Terran Forma, which is produced at CJSR. For the next half of an hour, before we come back to Laurie with the Mad Women's Underclothes at 2 o'clock. Please stay with us.
You are listening to CFRU, radio worth taking your glasses off for.
Welcome to a special edition of Terra Informa. I'm Rebecca Rooney, and I'll be your host for the next 30 minutes of environmental news. I mentioned that today's episode is a special one. Terra Informa is produced at CJSR in Edmonton. CJSR is a community-supported radio station that procures 45% of its annual operating budget from listener donations pledged during a 10-day-long fund drive that is happening right now. For fund drive, we are putting together a special hour-long episode, much of which will be broadcast live in the Edmonton area and from CJSR's website. But what you're listening to is a lot of the material that will air during the Fund Drive special, crammed into a mere 29 minutes. So strap yourself in and hold on tight, because this is going to get a little speedy. This week on the show, correspondent Suna brings us an expose on the mining and refining of rare earth metals, those critical but rare components of modern electronics. Steve Anderson and Carly Coleman bring us another bicycle traffic report. In this one, they'll be talking about the ABCs of bicycle maintenance. And finally, I'll chime in with a new science short profiling the Edmonton Urban Coyote Project, which aims to collect information on urban coyote habitat use, diet, and distribution. But first, here's Marcus Peterson with a rapid review of the environmental headlines from this week.
The most comprehensive report ever on the state of Canada's biodiversity calls for action to, quote, maintain functioning ecosystems, end quote, from BC's forests to the St. Lawrence River. The report, entitled Canadian Biodiversity, Ecosystem Status and Trends 2010, was quietly posted on the internet for the 10th meeting of the Conference of Parties to the Convention of Biological Diversity, which began last Monday in Japan. This 2010 assessment is a collaborative project of the Canadian federal, provincial, and territorial governments. It is based on technical reports prepared by more than 500 experts across the country. The report, billed as the first assessment of Canada's biodiversity from an ecosystem perspective, has been years in the making and is the most detailed assessment ever on the status of Canada's landscape, wildlife, and wild places. In 102 pages, the document highlights the need for action to, quote, maintain functioning ecosystems, end quote, in old forests, lakes, rivers, and agricultural lands. It also points to huge swaths of Canada where natural processes are compromised or increased stresses are reaching critical thresholds. The list includes fisheries, changes in the north, including the dramatic loss of sea ice, nutrient loading in the Great Lakes, and the spread of non-native invasive species in sensitive habitats. In some cases, populations have continued to decline or have not recovered despite the removal of human pressures. The news is not all bad, however. The report's executive summary says that over half of Canada's landscape remains intact and relatively free from human infrastructure. To read all 22 key findings of the biodiversity report, you can find a link on the terrainforma.ca website or go to biodivcanada.ca. The nonprofit watchdog Mining Watch Canada recently obtained a report commissioned by the Prospectors and Developers Association of Canada in 2009, but it was never released to the public. The report discusses 171 high-profile corporate social responsibility violations by international mining companies between 1999 and 2009. 63% of these violations are linked to companies from just 5 countries, including Canada. Canadian mining companies are especially guilty for these violations. They are involved in more than 4 times as many violations as the next 2 highest offenders, Australia and India. The report's authors conclude that, quote, Canadian companies have been the most significant group involved in unfortunate incidents in the developing world. Canadian companies have played a much larger role than their peers from Australia, the United Kingdom, and the United States. Canadian companies are much more likely to be engaged in community conflict, environmental, and unethical behavior. Importantly, the report also finds that a large majority of the Canadian mining companies involved in such violations already have corporate social responsibility policies in place. This was Terra Informa News with Marcus Peterson.
Thanks for that. You're tuned in to Terra Informa, your weekly digest of green news and issues. If you would like more information about any of the stories you hear on our show, check our website, www.terrainforma.ca. Have you ever heard of rare earth elements? They're also called rare earth metals. The term refers to 17 chemical elements, including the class of 15 chemically related elements with atomic numbers from 57 to 71. In 1787, they were discovered by a Swedish officer, and at first were used for grinding lenses in optical science industries. These days, rare earth elements are required in various industries, including electronics, medical, and petrochemical industries. However, it must be stressed that their extraction and refinement is very difficult and requires toxic chemicals that can cause serious environmental problems. This week, Terra Informa's correspondent Suna brings us a story about rare earth elements.
Rare earth elements, REE, are of great importance, especially in eco-friendly industries such as hybrid vehicles, rechargeable batteries, and wind power. The reasons why these rare earth elements are important in high-tech industry are they are smaller, lighter, and they are necessarily required to make stronger permanent magnets. Actually, 30% of rare earth elements are consumed in these researches of permanent magnet. And also, in wind power, REE is used on massive scale. For example, if 2 tons of permanent magnet is required for 1 wind power generator, about 28% of this magnet consists of REE. Nowadays, every year 97% of production of REE is made from China. Do you think this result is possible just because in China there are lots of burden of REE, lots of lower price workforce, and Chinese government doesn't care about the environment? The answer is uniqueness of the production process of REE. Only the countries which have spent a considerable amount of time finding bird places and researching the ways of mining and extracting could raise their competitiveness in the world market. 60 years ago, the USA had been the biggest producer of REE. In the mountain pass in California, large amount of REE, which was utilized as a component of television, was detected, and this mine had been the biggest supplier in the world until 1975. However, in March 1986, China started Project 863 to decrease the gap of scientific technology between Western developed countries, and in this project, development of REE was included. After 11 years, in 1997, China started Project 973, and technology of REE was included again. Thus, China could lead to tangible achievements after long-term studies with putting a plentiful capital. Unfortunately, while in this period, studies related to REE was an unpopular area, Western companies lost their competitiveness because of import from China since 90s, and finally, China could get a monopoly of REE in the world market. Now, let's consider other nations' response about this situation. First of all, some countries have been pondering ways to diversify the supplier of rare earth elements except for China. In case of Japan, they started official development assistance related to obtaining REE in Asia and Africa, since Japan is poor in REE resources. For example, Toyota took over the Vietnamese mine, it's called Dong Pao, and this mine will supply 4,000 tons of REE per year for 20 years since 2011. The USA, already securing enough resources, reactivates the mine in Mountain Pass from 2012 to produce 20,000 tons of REE every year. Second solution is to enhance the effectiveness of using resources, develop the substitute resources if it's possible, and recycle the REE resources. For instance, the Japanese National Institute for Material Science is studying ways to extract resources from waste electric and electronic equipment, and it's called urban mining. In addition, New Energy Development Organization is developing the technology to make electric cars without REE. Japanese companies and organizations expect that these researches will deal with REE resources from China. Thirdly, that is the ultimate solution. Saving the REE based on domestic consumption could ease the problem from Chinese monopolistic supply temporarily. Japanese government presented that they has doubled the amount of hoard of REE than in 2005's amount, which was for 22 days. The Pentagon is considering saving REE for 3 years according to their war plan. However, there is one thing we really need to keep an eye on because of REE industry effects on the environment. First of all, dust from the digging area causes pneumoconiosis to workers, and this could easily develop complications like tuberculosis, pneumothorax, and lung cancer. There are 5,387 people are suffered from pneumoconiosis in Batau in Inner Mongolia, which is the largest mine with REE resources. Actually, REE, rare earth elements, are buried all over the world, and the only problem is caused from the Chinese monopoly. So other nations will be mining developing countries' reclaimed area to obtain REE resources. And we need to prevent the environment of developing countries from being destroyed for producing REE, which is utilized for eco-friendly industries, paradoxically.
Thanks, Suna. This is Terra Informa, a half hour of green-themed radio, broadcast across Canada and on our website at www.terrainforma.ca. Next up, Steve talks to Terra Informa's bicycle traffic reporter, Carly Coleman, about how to keep your bike riding smoothly. Whether you're checking your bike over before putting it away for the winter or tuning it up for months of snowy riding, Carly's ABCs of bicycle maintenance are the perfect starting point. Carly served on the board of Edmonton's community bike shop for years and is an avid cyclist who spent this past summer touring all over Canada. Steve caught up with her at her home in Edmonton.
Today I stopped by Carly Coleman's house. Carly is Terra Informa's bicycle traffic reporter. And, you know, Carly, I've been noticing that my bike hasn't been running quite as smoothly as it did at the beginning of the year when I first purchased it. And I was hoping, since you've been traveling all over the country on your bike this summer, that maybe you could share a few tips on how to keep a bike running smoothly.
Well, Steve, really, there's some pretty basic things that you need to check right when you... right when you get on your bike, but it's actually before you get on your bike. The best thing to do to keep in mind is this, we like to call it the ABCs of the bicycle maintenance program. And that stands for air, brakes, and check. So air, not only are you looking at whether there's air in the tires, literally, you're also looking for, does the tire move in the fork smoothly? Does it have a wobble? Does it...
And the fork is the front part of your bike that holds the tire?
Yes, that is correct. And there's also the back where you want to check to see that the tire is moving smoothly within that frame of your bike. You want to make sure that the spokes are nice and tight, so, you know, spring them together in your little fingers to make sure that they're not incredibly wobbly, that they still have some tension on them. And once you've done that, then move on to the brake part of it all, and that is, where are your brakes on your tire? Have you braked so much that... the pads are worn off, or maybe they've moved down and they're rubbing the rim and they're just skimming past the spokes, so that if you wrenched on your brakes really tightly, you would actually drive your brakes into the spokes, and that would be...
That sounds like bad news.
That would be terrible. The other thing is you want to check to make sure that they're not so high they're rubbing on the actual tire, the rubber part of your wheel, because that will cause it to abrade and then cause a catastrophic failure of your wheel as well, which is another thing to be avoided, because that is just spectacularly bad.
So basically you want to make sure that your brake pads are touching right against the metal part of your wheel rim.
Okay. In the middle. And so that's the brake part of it. You want to actually as well check that all the lines, the cables to your brakes are functional, so that they move freely, that when you engage the brakes, your brake levers on your handlebars don't sink right to the handlebars. You want to make sure that you can get at least a hand's width in between them, so that if you torque on the brakes, you don't catch it, or you don't pull it so hard that when you pull the brake levers, you actually aren't stopped. So a nice way to test that is to straddle your bicycle and then engage the brakes and try and see if you can push your bike forward or backward. And if you can, in either direction, you should maybe check and see why. And you can learn how to do that, or you can take it into a shop and do that, or whatever the case may be. But it's best to have functional brakes when you're out in the world.
I could see that being helpful, yeah.
Yeah, and then the C part of the ABCs of mechanics, which is what we're talking about now, is how to make sure that your bike is generally good to ride. So you want to make sure that all the bits that move on it are moving freely, and all the bits that shouldn't move on it are not moving. So if you have a rack, for instance, you want to make sure that the bolts holding the rack on are tight. You want to make sure that if you're using any quick release levers for your wheels or your seats or anything else, you want to make sure they're fully engaged and tightly closed, and that as you cycle, your seat isn't sinking down or your wheels aren't coming out when you jump a curb and things like that. The other thing that you want to do with checking for the final check, lift your bike up a little bit so you can hear when I lift my bike up, there's nothing there that makes any noise that's untoward. And you don't have to lift the bike over your head or anything. It's just a couple inches off the ground. Lift it up, set it down, listen for rattles, find those rattles, determine what they are, tighten them, and there you are.
Great. So if somebody's riding along and they notice an odd noise or something, are there any sort of telltale signs, I guess is what I'm wondering, that your bike needs some maintenance?
There's a few. A squeak is generally a sign that your chain is not very happy and probably needs lubrication.
Okay.
Yeah. The rubbing, of course, you want to check to see that your wheels are seated properly. You want to check that your brakes aren't rubbing against any particular thing. If you're cycling smoothly and you hit a bump or something, and after you start again, it feels really hard to cycle, you want to check your brakes, and you want to check your alignment of your wheels in your forks and your dropouts as well.
Great. Are there any sorts of regular maintenance that a bicycle needs?
Yes. You need to love them.
Good advice.
Right. But apart from that, you need to oil their chains. You need to make sure that there's air in their tire. If you're riding in particularly dusty or dirty or wet conditions and you want to prevent corrosion and rusting, wiping it down after you get out of those conditions is a lovely idea. You'll make your bike live much, much longer and a much healthier life. Store your bike in direct sunlight all the time, because tires do degrade in sunlight, and you can tell that when they get little chips and cracks along the edge of the rubber, and eventually with time you can actually see the threads in the tire itself, and at that point it's well past time to replace your tire.
Okay, so follow the ABCs of bicycle maintenance to keep everything running smoothly.
Right, air, brakes, and a general check of everything.
Perfect. Thanks for the tips, Carly.
Hey, no worries.
Thanks, Steve, for helping us keep our bikes in smooth working order. The Terra Informa website is your go-to address for more information about bicycle maintenance or anything else you hear about on our show. www.terrainforma.ca. You can also subscribe to our Twitter feed or find us on Facebook. Urban coyotes are a growing issue around North America. In the last two decades, urban populations have sprung up in cities including Toronto, Vancouver, Calgary, and Edmonton. Now city residents are having to learn how to coexist alongside these opportunistic carnivores. The Edmonton Urban Coyote Project is a multifaceted study of coyotes based out of the University of Alberta. Their goal is to collect information on the movement, habitat selection, and diet of coyotes, as well as the knowledge and perceptions of residents. Maureen Murray is a master's student working on the project, and I met up with her in the Department of Biological Sciences to record this science short for you.
So I'm here with Maureen Murray, who's a master student at the University of Alberta. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
So tell me a little bit about your research.
So we're doing field research in the city of Edmonton to gather data on urban coyote habitat use and diet so that we can inform managers about how they're using the city, how they're traveling through the city, and what they're eating in the city so that they can better tailor an education campaign to reduce coyote attractants or, say, promote appropriate behavior for people when you encounter a coyote. Rather than running away from it, you should kind of be aggressive towards it and support aversive conditioning so they are scared of people rather than getting comfortable around people.
Okay. So how many coyotes are there in Edmonton? Do we have any idea?
I've heard estimates around 200, maybe. From our data, we've been noticing that home range sizes are a lot larger than we thought they were. One of our coyotes has a home range of 100 square kilometers. So if their home ranges are that big, there probably aren't that many of them. As opposed to, say, in Chicago, where they have 2,000 coyotes, they have quite small home ranges. So there isn't really a concrete estimate.
So are urban coyotes really an issue kind of across North America?
Yeah, for sure, especially in the United States. It started in kind of Midwestern United States in Arizona and California, and then has kind of spread east and north. So now, as I said, Chicago has a huge population. Now we're seeing occurrences in New York that were popping up over the summer, also up to Seattle, and then Canada more later. Now there's a big population in Vancouver and in Calgary and in Edmonton. So from southwestern United States, they've kind of spread northward and eastward.
And what are some of the issues that a city planner would face with having a coyote population?
Well, there have been a lot of issues with that, basically because your first instinct is, you know, to trap all the coyotes, to maybe put a bounty out on them, to either cull them or just take them out of the city. But counterintuitively, that actually increases the coyote population, because instead of only the older individuals reproducing, you're kind of destabilizing their social structure, so you have way more individuals who will reproduce. So you're getting more reproducing individuals and then more pup survival because there are more resources per coyote. So it's kind of interesting. You see the same thing in rats where they up their reproductive rate when they're being stressed. So instead of lethal management, we try to promote non-lethal management like public education because it's more sustainable and promotes kind of a better environment in the city. You know, you don't want to live in a place where there are traps everywhere and they're kind of sharpshooting animals in the city. Right. It's much better to, you know, reduce attractants, reduce the incentive for coyotes to be in your backyard, and also promote aversive conditioning where you make it a very negative experience for a coyote to encounter a human and to kind of reinstill that fear of humans in coyotes.
So how is your research helping, start with the attractants? How are you, how is your work helping to identify what might be attracting coyotes to the city?
Okay, well, twofold. We're doing habitat use study where we're looking at clusters of GPS points. Now we have these GPS collars on coyotes so we can track where they go. And if we find an area that they routinely revisit or spend a lot of time at, we visit those sites and see maybe what attractants were making them revisit that area. Maybe there is a big garbage site there that wasn't secured. Maybe it's a backyard that has a lot of fallen fruit from ornamental shrubs or something like that. We're also doing a diet study where we are measuring the frequency of prey types in their diet, such as like rodent, rabbit, or deer, or something like that. But we're also measuring the anthropogenic food in their scat. So right now we're limited to only looking at undigestible portions like plastic wrappers or thread or paper, something like that, that they might accidentally ingest when eating garbage. But in the future, we hope to use stable isotope analysis to identify corn sugars. So C4 versus C3 plant sugars. And conveniently enough, all human food basically has corn sugar in it because it's a lot cheaper. And corn is rare in a city, like a natural corn. So if you find a scat with C4 sugar in it, then it was probably from human food.
Oh, neat.
Yeah.
So you're able to, by monitoring where they're going, identify what might be attracting them there. And then how is that being translated back into public education?
again, there's a number of ways we're doing this. Say if we find that they're clustering their activity in natural areas, but then also the residential areas surrounding those natural areas, managers might target their efforts towards those neighborhoods that abut ravines or the river valley. So rather than, you know, spending a lot of money trying to target people that live in the core of the city, they might